You say it's for the war, but I think it's for the money. You say it's for us all, well, I think that's pretty funny. Getting rich is easy when you hide behind your country. Wave the flag, collect the bounty.
This is a Building Bridges, your Community and Labor Report special. I'm Ken Nash.
And I'm Mimi Rosenberg. Mumia Abu-Jamal, the renowned journalist on Philadelphia's death row since 1981, provides us with a political commentary connecting the Iraq War with the diminution of resources at home, healthcare, education, and jobs. The struggle against the war is the struggle against poverty at home and against the class war being waged against us all.
They smile as they say, boys, we're in this thing together. There's a war to be won to make this old world better.
The war against us all. This war in Iraq isn't the end. It's the beginning of wars to come all around the world at the whim of the neocons in the White House. This is the Bush Doctrine come to life. War, war, and more war. War brought to you by the big corporate masters who run the show. This isn't just a war on Iraqis or Afghanis or even Arabs or Muslims. It is ultimately a war on us all. That's because the billions and billions of dollars that are being spent on this war, the cost of tanks, rocketry, bullets, and yes, even salaries for the 125,000 plus troops, is money that will never be spent on education, on health care, on the reconstruction of crumbling public housing, or to train and place the millions of workers who have lost manufacturing jobs in the past 3 years alone. The war in Iraq is, in reality, a war against the nation's workers and the poor, who are getting less and less while the big defense industries are making a killing, literally. What's next? Iran? Syria? North Korea? Venezuela? We've already seen the corporate media play megaphone to the White House to build and promote a war based on lies. It's been a long time ago, but that great Russian revolutionary Leon Trotsky said, war is utilized by the imperialists first and foremost to crush internal enemies. We're seeing the truth of his insight when we see the sad state of American education, the rush of seniors to buy affordable medications from the Canadians because American drugs are just too expensive, the threatened privatization of Social Security, and the wave of repression that comes with an increasingly militarized police. Does the Homeland Security Department make you feel any safer? In Black America, things get grimmer every day as resources that are already scarce begin to shrink even further. Young people feel that prisons are a rite of passage, an inevitable place to visit, and a decent job seems like a distant dream. This is a war on all of us, and the struggle against war is really a struggle for a better life for the millions of folks who are in need here in this country. The fight against the war is really to fight for your own interests, not the false interests of the defense industries or the corporate media or the White House. Down with the wars for empire. From death row, this is Mumia Abu-Jamal.
Wave the flag, collect the bounty. And when we get to the end.
And now to continue the discussion of the war against us all, Francis Fox Piven, author of The War at Home, The Domestic Costs of Bush's Militarism, examines the ways the war on terror serves to shore up the Bush administration's political base and analyzes the manner in which flag-waving politicians have used the emotional fog of war to further their regressive social and economic agendas.
How long can this go on? There's money to be made singing Stars and Stripes forever. They smile as they say, boys, we're in this thing together.
The legacy of the George W. Bush administration is to do a lot of damage to ordinary working class Americans and to poor people, and probably a lot of damage also to the society as a whole because of the cutbacks on infrastructure spending by the federal government. It's not only poor people who are getting cut. We're all getting cut. For example, the new budget eliminated Amtrak subsidies. So we'll be a very big country without a railroad. Amazing. Or look at what's happening, for example, to the New York City subways. Every week, practically, lines go out because of fires, because of the failure to maintain the system. At the same time, the Bush administration has slashed taxes on the affluent and on corporations. It has given large subsidies to the pharmaceutical companies. It has, under the radar screen, given subsidies to the energy companies. And it is campaigning against labor rights, union rights, civil service rights. This is a kind of domestic agenda that started with Ronald Reagan in 1980. It's a strong business-oriented agenda. The basic idea is to try to shore up business profits by taking from the rest of us, and doing this partly by taking from the programs that we depend on, doing it partly by stripping away the regulations that hamper business but make our air clean or our water clean. The question that I raised in the book didn't have to do so much with the basic form of this neoliberal or right-wing agenda, but rather the relationship of the war in the Middle East to this agenda. Why were we at war? The fact of the matter is, we don't really know why we went into Iraq. The administration gave us reasons at the beginning. They said weapons of mass destruction. They said that Iraq had ties to Osama bin Laden. The reasons that they have given have since been disproved. Now, at the last minute, the Bush administration has generated this almost new reason. We are in the Middle East to make Iraq a kind of exemplary democracy for the rest of the Middle East and perhaps the rest of the world. But their reasons really don't have any credibility. Other foreign policy experts have puzzled over why did they undertake this extraordinary militaristic initiative? It doesn't make sense to think it's just for oil. After all, we didn't have an oil shortage at the time that we went to war. Now we have an oil shortage. It doesn't make sense that we did it just to demonstrate our military power to the rest of the world. The rest of the world knew that we were the military power. However, if you look within at what's happening domestically, you can make more sense of this war. First, domestically, war means big defense spending, and the military and the defense establishment are a very important part of the Bush constituency. Also, war and war excitement helped to hold together the Republican coalition, because just feeding the military causes cracks in that coalition. There are a lot of deficit hawks in the coalition, a lot of people who think that government should be smaller, not bigger. But finally, and most important, going to war gave Bush and the Republican Party a tremendous lift in the election of 2002 and the election of 2004. Foreign wars are something that leave people sort of helpless. They don't understand what's going on in Iraq. They have no way to test what their leaders say. And war at the same time is very exciting. So they're vulnerable to fears that are provoked by political leaders who talk about the threats out there. And at the same time, there's a kind of excitement that's created by both the emergency and the rally round the flag kind of spirit. So if you think about it, Bush was falling in the polls when 9/11 occurred. He went into a kind of spin for a little while. You know, he was circling around in Air Force One, but when he reemerged, it was with a plan to reemerge as our commander-in-chief and our anointed savior at this time of national emergency. And that gave him a tremendous boost. And the polls show pretty clearly now that it was not the values issue, not same-sex marriage and abortion, that delivered the election in 2004 to Bush, but it was the war on terror. So war, it may not give them international power. That remains to be seen. It may have cost us or cost them in terms of their international clout, but it certainly has given them domestic power. And they've used that domestic power to push through this right-wing agenda that we talked about a few moments ago. One of the points I make in the book is that historically, when political leaders have rallied the population for war, they have been successful in the short run. For a short period of time, the excitement of war, the patriotism, the fear succeeds in mobilizing people so that they, their sons, their daughters, are willing to march off to get killed, to get maimed, and they're also willing to sacrifice a part of their own economic well-being, their own wealth, for wars being fought by their leaders. But as time goes on, it becomes harder to mobilize this kind of sacrifice from among ordinary people. And if the war continues, the historical evidence argues that leaders have to make concessions to their population in order to cement their allegiance and to make them willing to continue their sacrifices. So we have a kind of irony. Foreign wars have, in the past, been the occasions when democratic rights have been expanded in Europe and in the United States, and they've also been the occasions when social welfare programs have expanded. But this administration, so far, it's doing the opposite. During the Vietnam War, 18-year-olds got the right to vote in the United States. The Vietnam War was already underway when the Voting Rights Act was passed, which really was the legislation which gave African Americans the right to vote in the United States. They had the right to vote in the North, but most African Americans were in the South still. And also during the war, Lyndon Baines Johnson expanded programs for the cities, worked very, very hard, and in fact destabilized the American economy in order to provide what was called guns and butter. So I would say that although certainly there were crackdowns on dissenters during the Vietnam War, as there are during every war, and there will be during this war, that with regard to sort of mass concessions, governments have tried in the past to deliver. Look at World War II and the GI Bill of Rights, which was probably the best social welfare package that we've ever seen in this country. Or if you go back further, after the Civil War, the national government inaugurated a Civil War pensions program that reached really a lot of people in the United States. And the same pattern holds true in England. World War I, the women's vote. World War II, the big expansion of welfare state programs in Western Europe. But my point was, they're not doing it. They're doing the opposite. It's true that they're talking as though they're doing it. They're taking a lot of credit for being compassionate conservatives, the Medicare Prescription Drug Act, which is better for the pharmaceutical companies than it will be for seniors. But in fact, they're whittling away at a lot of programs. Medicaid is now a big target of the new budget proposal. And what they have squarely in their sights is the Social Security program. They're claiming that what they're going to do is divert Social Security taxes into private accounts, which will give everyone a kind of nest egg that they'll pass. I mean, but this is all, and that Social Security won't be affected, at least for people who are in late middle age. But basically, they want to get Social Security. Social Security has been a thorn in the side of American business since it was first passed in 1935. They don't like that program, and they don't like it for a number of reasons, not least of which is the fact that there's this big public reserve that smacks of socialism or potential socialism to them. It's trying to make it appear that its initiatives are generous. The No Child Left Behind Act, the Prescription Drug Act, it's trying to present its Social Security initiatives as a step toward the ownership society. But if I'm right, and if domestic plunder was an important part of their reason for going to war, if their target was not so much Iraqi oil as the fog of war itself and what that would make possible in pushing through the right-wing agenda of tax cuts for the rich and social spending cuts for the rest of us. If that was their reason, then they can't really do what other regimes have done, which is to try to placate their population and seal their loyalty by initiating new forms of social protection, social spending, and an expanded democracy. But, you know, it is just the beginning. And I wanted to say something more about the anti-war movement. You know, it grew in the case of the Vietnam War over a period of some 6 or 7 years. It took a long time before we got really huge crowds of people to Washington or marching in Central Park. That's one point I wanted to make. So we shouldn't be too impatient and we shouldn't despair. Every movement has its ups and downs, its period where it flares and where it dwindles and then it rebuilds its strength and it reemerges. But the second point I wanted to make is that we also shouldn't think that protest movements consist simply of big crowds, of demonstrations and parades. The most important kinds of action in a real, strong, definitive anti-war movement will be those kinds of defiance, those kinds of action, which will really throw a monkey wrench into the war effort. So, for example, the counter-recruiting efforts that are now being talked about among school teachers and among anti-war counselors. These are very, very important, especially when we also read that the Army and the Marines are having big recruiting problems. And we have to begin to think about the kinds of ways that ordinary people, in the course of doing their work, living their lives, are cooperating in the war effort, whether they intend to or not, and to figure out how to mobilize their disaffection, their non-cooperation, their defiance. It's through that kind of action that a powerful anti-war movement can be built. They smile as they say, boys, we're in it's just together. Begun.
There's a war to be won to make this old world better. Your country's gonna win, boys, if you'll only let her.
You've been listening to Frances Fox Piven, author of The War at Home, The Domestic Costs of Bush's Militarism.
Months after the United States bombing and invasion of Iraq on May 20, 2003 at Riverside Church, Ozzie Davis delivered a stirring speech on the 36th anniversary of the Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King Jr.'s speech opposing the Vietnam War.
Thank you. I am indeed Ossie Davis. I say that so that those whose duty it is to report my behavior back to the proper authorities I am not as smart as Miss Condoleezza Rice. though she is yet my sister, nor so faithful unto death as General Colin Powell, though he is yet my brother. They have their sense of duty. I have mine. They are loyal to their commander-in-chief, and I am loyal to mine. My commander-in-chief is Martin Luther King, Jr. And more than 30 years ago, he stood in these sacred halls and gave me my marching orders. Though I was predisposed to peacemongering long before I met Dr. King, it started for me with a jolt on that day, August the 7th, when the atomic bomb was dropped on Hiroshima, and I was a soldier, 28 years old, faced with the brutal consequences of what my country had done. It was a period that left me in depression, trying to find an answer, because I knew the quandary into which these acts had led us. I fully understood that our technology and our humanity were in full balance, which one would lead us to the future was the question. I watched in horror when I left the service as my country used the atomic bomb as the center of its foreign policy. How the march away from colonialization in Africa and other places was affected by that concept of ourselves, which under the aegis of Mr. Churchill and also Mr. Truman set out to establish their vision of a world where we had a second-class place and were implored to remain in that position. I saw the struggle for people to be free. I saw the stand we took in 1954 when France was faltering as she tried to reimpose colonialism in Southeast Asia. And when France falled at Dien Bien Phu, I saw us step in and take over. I saw even then that we were on a course that could well lead to destruction. And much later, in the war that came subsequent to that, I saw the country engaged in what Dr. King told us on that night was adventures based on militarism, racism, and poverty, which it was more constrained to pursue than peace and justice and equanimity all over the world. I became that night, as many of you did, citizens who were also drum majors for justice. Drum majors for justice, second class, glad to be recruited. I thought, with the pain and anguish of Vietnam, that my country had learned a lesson, that we had decided that there was an end to our reliance on technological tricks and gimmickry. But I see today that I have been mistaken. As I read once again the magnificent words of Dr. King upon that occasion and saw how easily we might this very night transpose the word Vietnam for Iraq, and the document would still be an eloquent cry for sanity and for peace. I have never looked upon myself as a magician. I was not sent by the Almighty to solve all the problems of the world at one fell swoop. I am not morally arrogant. I accept the fact that maybe this generation was not the one designed by fate to bring peace to the world. But I also believe that it is necessary to stay on the march, to be on the journey, to work for peace wherever we are at all times. Because the liberty we cherish, which we would share with the world, demands eternal vigilance. And democracy is no easy path. But those of us who believe in it must be prepared to sacrifice in its cause more willingly than those who are prepared to die in wars of aggression. We too must be dedicated to the cause of freedom. And so tonight, I'm happy to join once again with those of you who see the cause as I do. I say to my commanding officer, Martin, here we are. Arcee, Ruby, our children and grandchildren, all our house, all of us, join with millions from one end of creation to the other. Martin, we report for duty, sir. Thank you.
Ozzie Davis! Do that hide behind walls. Do that hide behind desks. I just want you to know I can see through your masks. You that never done
And this has been Building Bridges, your community and labor report, produced by Mimi Rosenberg and Ken Nash. And you can reach us at knash@igc.org. That's knash@igc.org.
Run further when the fast bullets fly. Come, you master.
Leave the revolutionary time. Leave the revolutionary time.